and I will not allow it." Kerrigan held her breath as the two brothers fixed their eyes on one another, each reading deep into the other's soul. Zachary's hand lashed out, and he snatched the black stone. Then he froze, just short of yanking it off its gold chain, unable to release it. Bolts of energy burst between his fingers and coiled up his arm. His mouth gaped open in a silent scream. Another current erupted from the stone and fused into Hamilton Shaudel's chest. He closed his eyes and inhaled deeply, as if taking in fresh air. His hair acquired a radiant golden sheen. Fashtin ran full tilt across the throne room to aid the king. With the flick of Hamilton Shaudel's hand, a bolt of energy tossed Fashtin across the width of the throne room and against a pillar. The weapon crumpled to the floor. Kerrigan knit her eyebrows together. She watched in disbelief, shaking her head. "No," she muttered. "This isn't right."
"What?"
Her father was still addled from his ordeal.
"I was wrong!"
Her voice raised an octave in urgency.
"Using the magic doesn't exhaust him. It feeds him. It empowers him."
Hamilton Shaudel's intensity grew and spread out from him like a black aura that pushed away the light. Zachary's eyes bulged, but he remained unmoving, statue still, trapped in a web of magical currents. Captain Mapstone drew her sword, but Merwell caught her arm.
"The final play of intrigue," he shouted.
Beryl raised her hand to strike him, but he turned on her.
"Axiom cor helio dast, moor our haven."
The words rumbled from his throat like thunder, and Kerrigan thought the very air must splinter beneath their weight. Expression drained from Beryl's face. She bowed to Merwell.
"Command me, my lord."
"Kill Captain Mapstone."
Her sword sprang into her hand. The clash of steel rang in the distilled atmosphere of the throne room. Conley intervened to help the captain repel Beryl's attack, but she used her sword in a mindless and savage way, causing them both to fall back. Her sword tore and thrust with a life of its own, and the two did all they could to simply defend themselves. Merwell chortled. Kerrigan had to help the king. She tore loose of her father's grip. With the sword of the first rider clenched in her hand, she charged toward King Zachary and Hamilton Shaudel.
"Kerry!" her father shouted. "Look out!"
Something snarled and hurtled out of the shadows at her, knocking her down. Kerrigan sprawled on her side, the sword skittering across the floor out of reach. She took a couple of deep breaths to get air back into her lungs and raised herself to her elbow. Jendara knelt on one knee beside her, her sword tip pressed against her chest. Footsteps approached from behind.
"Back off, merchant," Jendara said,
her eyes never leaving Kerrigan. Her jaw was set, her eyes narrowed. She looked a raptor, ready to plunge on its prey with talons spread.
"Back off, or my sword will taste more of her blood, and yours as well."
Kerrigan sensed her father hesitating behind her.
"Go," she said. "She means it."
She heard his feet pad away, and the low tones of his voice as he exchanged words with Savano. Kerrigan gazed up the length of Jindara's bright blade.
"You shouldn't stop me," she said.
"You should have killed me when you had the chance," Jindara replied.
"It was not my way."
Proud Jindara had diminished, it seemed to Kerrigan, as if her spirit had been beaten out of her. Her fierce, hawk-like features sagged and were marred by bruises, cuts, and swelling. Had she guessed wrong about Jindara all that while ago? Had she guessed wrong that there was enough good in her worth saving? Or had Freyan Kobolbay been right? Jindara had not killed her outright, and that was something, she supposed, a gleam of hope. The din of Captain Mapstone's fight with Beryl seemed to shake Jindara from her thoughts.
"I cannot let you interfere with King Hamilton," she said. "We have worked too hard and waited too long for him to claim what has always been his by right."
"Your king is dying."
Jindara glanced over her shoulder, the ringlets of her lush, russet hair shimmering. She seemed to hesitate, and Kerrigan took the advantage. Not with a weapon, for she had none. but with words. When I fade out, I can see it. I can see the Elysian. The stone he wears binds them together, but soon the Elysian will absorb Amelton completely. There will be no King Amelton, no Amelton, period. If you stop me, there won't be a King Zachary either, just the Elysian. Who knows what will become of Sacharidia then?
Jindara shook her head. A variety of emotions battled in her eyes.
You must see it yourself, Kerrigan said, feeling the time pass like blood gouting from a wound. Is he the same man you pledged to protect, or has he changed?
Her voice took on a tone of desperation. With every passing moment, the Elysian grew stronger, and King Zachary came closer to dying. She could not let him die. Yet there was little she could do on the wrong end of Jindara's sword. She would not escape a second time.
He is dying. Don't you understand? They are both dying. They are being sacrificed to augment the Elysian's power.
Jindara's eyes searched hers. She pursed her lips. Then, with a growl, she stood up and drove her sword home into its sheath. She grasped Kerrigan's wrist and hauled her to her feet.
I know it, she said. I guess I have known it. He is not who he was. What will you do?
Separate them.
Jindara snatched up the sword of the first rider and thrust the hilt into Kerrigan's hand. As Kerrigan took it, their fingers brushed, and in a bare half-second, Kerrigan understood Jindara's own sacrifice. No matter how this ended, it would not go well for her.
Jindara,
I've made the right decision for once, Jindara said.
She pushed Kerrigan in the direction of the dais. There is no time to lose. Kerrigan had been wrong. Jindara's spirit had not diminished, but had grown brighter. Yet, she had not been wrong that there was still goodness to be found in the woman. She turned to the king and his brother. King Zachary's back was arched, blood trickling from his nose. His cheeks had gone hollow, his flesh pasty, and his hair had dulled, as if his very life force was leaking away. In contrast, Amelton Shardell's expression was exultant. His hair was now completely golden. The sword in Kerrigan's hand repelled the dark of Amelton Shardell, as it must have ages ago in the hands of the first rider during the long war. She passed into the aura of darkness, and the magic hummed all about her and prickled her flesh. She raised the blade above her head and struck downward. She cleaved through the gold chain that bound the black stone to Amelton Shardell's neck. King Zachary toppled away like a stiff column of granite. The black stone slipped from his hand. When it hit the floor, black energy flared up in a curtain around Kerrigan, as if she were in the eye of a storm of black lightning. A tendril of magic arced across the ceiling, scorching a black, jagged line through the portrait of King Amagast Hillander. The last thing Kerrigan heard was the terrible dual scream of Amelton Shardell. Then, the world went white. Triad. Kerrigan was stretched out on a cold, hard surface. Her eyes fluttered open to white, gauzy white. Linen tickled her nose and eyelashes.
Gods!
She tore off the shroud and sat up, panting. The sight that met her eyes was not much more reassuring. She was surrounded by a milky white landscape and sky, if they could be called such. White plains stretched infinitely in all directions. The sky possessed no sun, clouds, or moon. It was simply white. There was no differentiation, no horizon, no undulating terrain, no defining lines. Nothing broke or blemished the all-pervasive white. Even the green of her uniform was washed out, as if this strange place could not endure color. Her skin had gone pale. Worse still, suspended above her by no means she could detect, was a portrait of herself, like a mirror image, only like a sleeper with her eyes shut and hands folded across her chest. A death portrait.
Gods!
Kerrigan rolled off the stone slab. It looked exactly like the ones she had seen along Heroes Avenue inscribed with funerary symbols.
and tablets adhered to the base depicting scenes from the deceased's life. The tablets on this slab showed images of her journey. She fought the creature of Canmer in vain on one tablet. On another, she faced off with Torn, and in a third, she rode Condor at full gallop. She put her hand to her temple. "Is this death?" Her voice sounded small and muffled. A moving, billowing vapor rolled and tumbled across the plain. In no time, it converged upon her and whisked about her, obscuring the white world with yet another layer of cottony white. It enveloped and pressed in on her. She turned round and round, looking for a clearing or point of reference, but the vapor was all-pervasive. Attempts to wave it away simply caused it to swirl and eddy in dizzying patterns. She paused, breathless. The vapor moved by her in ragged shreds, and as quickly as it came, it drifted away and unveiled two rows of funeral slabs, each laden with an occupant. "Not again," she thought with foreboding. She passed between the slabs slowly. The shrouds draped the corpses in such a way that she could clearly discern the outlines of their features. Fashion, Mel, King Zachary, Savano, Captain Mapstone, her father. With a cry, she clawed the shroud of her father. It rustled to the ground beside her. She shook him and patted his cheeks, but his flesh was cold, his body stiff.
"No!"
Light, musical laughter rippled around her.
"Dead," a voice said. "The Elysian."
Kerrigan looked in all directions, but no one was there.
"If this is death," she shouted, "where are all the other spirits?"
"Dead."
His voice tolled like a sonorous bell. On the verge of weeping, Kerrigan went to Captain Mapstone's slab. She peeled back the shroud. Here, the captain looked far more peaceful in death than she ever had in life. She was dressed in her full formal uniform, with its gold captain's cords on the shoulders and silken sash tied around her waist. She clasped the hilt of her saber in her hands. Her winged horse brooch gleamed coldly in the white light of the world. Kerrigan's own brooch resonated, and without knowing how she knew to do so, she touched the captain's brooch.
"I am not dead," she said.
A voice in her head responded, "True."
"I am dead."
"False." "Dead," the Elysian cried.
"False."
"You must not disturb the dead."
Kerrigan snatched her hand away from the captain's brooch and turned, heart thumping, to find Agamon of the Tombs observing her. He carried a cloth in his hands and bent over Captain Mapstone to polish her saber.
"Where are we?"
she asked him, relieved to see another living being, even if it was Agamon. Agamon hummed tunelessly as he polished.
"Agamon!"
The little man faltered and gazed at her with a perplexed expression.
"Huh?"
"Where are we?"
He peered at her through his specs.
"It is a transitional place."
Kerrigan licked her lips. Her mouth was dry, and the vapor had left an acrid taste in it.
"Why are we here?"
She gestured at the corpses.
"They are," he said. "What could be?"
Not dead yet, she thought, but could be.
"Agamon," she said, "you must show me the way back."
"I cannot."
"Why?"
Desperation crept back into her voice.
"I need to go back. I need to help the others, the king."
He looked her up and down and clucked.
"I attend to the dead. You are touched by the dead, but not dead, not yet."
"Agamon!"
She clutched his sleeve.
"Please, show me the way out."
He simply stared at her with his frightened hair expression until she let him go. He readjusted his robes and waggled the specks on the end of his nose.
"You cannot leave once you enter," he said.
"False,"
the voice vibrated in her mind.
"Do not forget the sword," he said, "or she will be unhappy."
He pointed into the distance. Thunderous hooves clamored in her ears after so much silence. Far off, a horse and rider galloped across the plain in silhouette. In moments, they disappeared. Kerrigan glanced down at Captain Mapstone. The saber clenched in her hands was no longer her own, but that of the first rider. Kerrigan pried it from her stiff fingers. At the sound of humming, Kerrigan pivoted just in time to see Agamon scuttling away, his legs working beneath his long robes.
"Agamon, wait!"
She darted after him, but no matter how fast she ran, she could not gain on him. He grew smaller and smaller as the gulf between them expanded, his aimless humming fading until he disappeared altogether.
"Agamon!"
Kerrigan wailed, but the heaviness of the white air muted her voice. Behind her, the vaporous mist, noiseless and suffuse, billowed in again and obscured the funeral slabs. When the cloud wafted away, nothing remained save the endless white plains. Out of breath, Kerrigan collapsed to the white ground. She drew her legs up close and rested her head on her knees. She sat like this for a time, resting, willing herself to stave off despair. It could have been minutes she sat there. It could have been hours. Eventually, she stood up and walked. There was nothing else to do but walk across the colorless plain. Short, white grass crunched beneath her feet. Otherwise, nothing fed her senses. She wondered if she simply walked in place, for she could not identify any changes in her surroundings. She recalled the sprig of bayberry she carried tucked away in an inner pocket of her greatcoat, and took it out. A gift given to her so she could remember the vast expanses of the northern forest and the green, living things. So she could remember friends. The sprig of bayberry defied the bleaching effect of the world, and Kerrigan's eyes feasted on it. She rubbed a smooth leaf between her fingers. Its sweet scent brought back the bright blueberry blue eyes of the Berry Sisters, and the green needles of a giant pine tree which had towered over Abram Rust. It brought back the earthy smell of the forest after a rain, and of pine needles baking in the sun. Kerrigan rejoiced in the reawakening of her senses, of touching something real in this dull unreality. As if in response to her rising spirits, a dark blotch appeared on the plain before her. Her pace quickened into a trot. Her strides brought the splotch closer, as though she had taken great leaps instead of steps. The splotch turned into two figures who sat hunched over a table. Kerrigan slackened her pace, hope turning into dismay. Hamilton sat in one chair, and the Elysian in another. A third chair was left unoccupied. The table and chairs were made of ordinary wood, or appeared to be. On the table, a game of intrigue was set up. Like the bayberry sprig, the pieces retained their true colors, blue, green, red. Hamilton leaned over an army of red pieces, his eyes darting here and there over the board. He wrung his hands anxiously, reached out to move a piece, hesitated, and snatched his hand back. He muttered to himself, unaware of Kerrigan's presence. Shaudel the Elysian, in contrast, leaned casually back in his chair, watching her approach with interest.
"Won't you join us?" he asked.
Kerrigan adjusted her grip on the sword. "Why are we here?" The Elysian smiled his dazzling smile. In this place, he was not bloodied or injured from their previous encounter at the Lost Lake, nor was he the ghostly image she had seen overlapping Hamilton in the throne room.
"Would you believe anything I told you?" he asked.
"I will judge your words for myself."
"You will not like what you hear."
"Just explain," Kerrigan said.
"All right."
Shaudel's voice was quiet.
"With your actions, you have released wild magic, and it has torn the wall between the worlds. You brought us here."
"What do you mean, between the worlds?"
"This is a place of passage neither here nor there. It is not of the earth, nor of your mortal heavens. You have touched it before when you rode with the ghosts, but only the borders. You did not cross over. Many others touch it with their dreams or in death. Some find their way here with magic, but that is rare. This place is not always of the corporeal, but often of images and symbols.
I don't believe you. Chardel shrugged.
As you wish, though I suspect if you consulted Captain Mapstone's brooch, you would know the truth of my words. How else would you explain all this?
The brooch was gone, and it did not speak to her, but it did not matter. All that mattered was leaving this place, getting back to the king. How do we get back? She asked. Chardel mocked her with his light and musical laughter.
You would trust me with the answer. You, who will not believe the truth about where we are.
She glared at him, and he stopped laughing. He leaned forward and drew his eyebrows together in an expression of the utmost gravity.
To leave, we must finish the game. You must sit down and play. Won't you have a seat?
He gestured at the empty chair. Kerrigan ignored the proffered chair, but looked the game board over. On her side of the board, green pieces stood in formation. She looked closely, for their features were familiar. One carried a great axe on his shoulder. Abram Rust. Miss Bayberry leaned on a cane. Somiel, Softfeather, Arms Master Rendell, the little boy Dusty, and others she knew all had their places. King Zachary sat upon the green throne. Weapons stood behind him, with hands on the hilts of their swords. Captain Mapstone and Beryl Spencer faced one another with their swords drawn. Several pieces lay in the dead position. Freean Coblebay, Joy Overway, and numerous other green riders, weapons, and soldiers. Hamilton's pieces consisted of Merwellian soldiers and mercenaries. There was one-handed Captain Emeraz, flanked by Sarge and Thursgad. Merwell faced the battling Captain Mapstone and Beryl Spencer. Jindara stood just outside the action. The very image of Hamilton sat on the red throne. Likewise, Chardel sat on the blue throne. The two pieces were close together. A black thread of energy flowed between them. One more piece stood before them, a green piece. Kerrigan did not need to look at it closely to know who it represented. Chardel's pieces thronged on the borders of the Green King's realm. They were ground mites and other twisted creatures with hideous faces, wings, and claws. Denizens, no doubt, of Canmer and Vane.
I don't want to play, Kerrigan said.
I thought you wanted to leave this place, Chardel said. You must win the game to leave.
No, Kerrigan said.
No? You are the triad. You have been throughout. The unexpected player of the game. The player none of us knew how to counter. Not Merwell, Hamilton, or myself. Zachary, however, managed to woo you to his side early on.
Don't twist it, Kerrigan said. I chose.
We never knew what you would do next, Chardel said, as if he had not heard her. Other pieces supported you, and others hindered you. I suppose it is too late for me to coax you to our side. We would make an incomparable match.
His smile was charming, his eyes warm. He held his hand out to her. Kerrigan recoiled.
I could show you things you never dreamed of, he said. I could give you power 1,000 times that of the horse trinket you wear. A simple mortal king like Zachary is not good enough for you. You've a temperament that requires much, much more.
He folded his hands on the table, and with earnest eyes he said,
It pains me to admit it, but I find you most intriguing for a mortal, Kerrigan Glavian. What do you think about immortality? I have the power, to grant it.
Kerrigan sputtered, her mind a whirl and appalled by all he implied. Is that what you offer to Hamilton? Immortality? She glanced at the prince, who was oblivious to everything but the game board.
What I offer to Hamilton is between him and me, and needless to say, it is quite different than what I offer you.
This couldn't be happening, could it? Immortality? To spend all her days with Shardell the Elysian? The one who unthinkingly killed so many for his own purposes? She could never cross over to his side. This one thing, at least, she knew. I made my choice long ago, she said. I made my choice free of false promises and coercion. Shardell's expression was one of genuine regret.
My promises are not false. I wish you would join me, for we could share more than power.
He paused to allow his words time to sink in.
Since you have refused my offer, there is no alternative. I ask again, won't you finish the game?
Kerrigan hated intrigue. She always lost. By rising to Shardell's challenge, she doomed King Zachary, her father, all her friends. She doomed Sacharidia. She nodded toward Hamilton, who still muttered to himself and dithered over the game board. Why doesn't he make a move?
He moves when I give him leave, Shardell said.
And when do you move? Shardell crooked a golden eyebrow.
I move when you sit down to play.
You mean everything is just stalled?
It is a stalemate.
And if I refuse to sit? Shardell slowly smiled.
We share an eternity in this place. But if you play the game, you have a chance to win.
Why don't you use your magic? Kerrigan asked.
Play the game, Shardell said.
Why don't you use your magic? She repeated. Shardell's posture grew rigid. Hamilton, too, tensed, and his murmuring increased in urgency.
Play the game, Shardell said. It is the only way you can leave.
Kerrigan laughed, giddy with sudden insight. The essence of her insight, the only truth to be found in this unreality, was far more mundane than simple magic. She was the triad, the random element. She could spur the game on, or maintain the stalemate. She controlled the game. I won't break the stalemate, she said. The colorful game pieces reflected on the shiny blade of the first rider. She bent close to Shardell and whispered, You are too weak to break it yourself. And if this place was a combination of symbols, images, and the corporeal, she raised the sword over her head. Shardell quailed. The sword slashed down like a scythe. It plummeted down between the enthroned pieces of Hamilton and Shardell, severing the black thread that linked them. The blade bit into the cork game board and green, blue, and red pieces scattered. The sword carved deep into the table and through it. A roar grew louder and louder in Kerrigan's ears, like a great whoosh of air, the screams of Shardell and Hamilton. The table split into two neatly sliced halves. Shardell and Hamilton, one the mirror of the other, brought their arms up as if to ward off some invisible blow, their faces averted. Cracks crazed their images, and they shattered into thousands of tiny fragments. Still, the sword descended. It plowed into the white earth and sank deep. It kept sinking. The ground engulfed the blade, the hilt, her hand. It swallowed her wrist and forearm and elbow. Still, the sword descended. The ground took her shoulder. It took her all the way. The blade rang on the stone floor of the throne room. Gold links from the chain that had held the black stone around Hamilton's neck rained to the floor in pieces. The black stone bounced again, and when it struck the floor, It cracked. Wild magic escaped from it. The magic crackled and shot across the room in a black streak, hungry and vengeful. It found Kerrigan's sword and sizzled up the blade. She flung it aside, but still the tendrils leapt off it and lashed onto her like a live creature, a predator sustained by the screams of Shaudel and Hamilton. She added her own screams as the wild magic twined around her torso and around each limb. It pulsed on her flesh, strangling the life from her. The other faces in the throne room blurred in her tearing eyes. Hamilton's arms were outstretched to the ceiling, as if he reached for his father painted there. Even without her brooch, Kerrigan could see the ghostly, bloodied figure of the Elysian being drawn out of him. A black current of magic burrowed through Kerrigan's flesh and into her shoulder. She writhed as the black thing sank deeper, crawled under her skin, wriggled in her muscle. Smoke drifted up from the fabric of her coat. She smelled her own burning flesh. Old hurts reignited, the burns on her wrists from the creature of Canmer and Vane, the bite of Imerez's whip on her shoulder, the countless knocks, bruises, scrapes, abuses. Her side was wet with blood. The thing probed deeper, and she moaned with pain. She knew with some part of her that it sought out her heart, and strove to twist and twine like poison through every sinew of her body. On the periphery of her vision, a shadow with a sword looked down at her with steely eyes. The shadow tossed her mane of russet hair over her shoulder and turned to the screaming Hamilton. The sword streamed through the air like the tail of a falling star and plunged into Hamilton. The scream stopped short, though its residue clung to the stone walls of the throne room. Hamilton crumpled. The silver fillet fell from his head and rolled across the floor to King Zachary's feet. It spun there like a coin until he grasped it with a trembling hand. The Elysian faded from existence like a puff of smoke. Kerrigan groaned as the last vestiges of magic left her body and the accompanying pain dissipated. Her father's face clarified in her hazy vision as he looked down at her. Savano and some blonde, green-eyed lady who looked vaguely familiar also gazed down on her.
"Kerry," her father said hoarsely.
"Ah," was all she could say. He clasped her hand. His hand was warm, and its weathered texture felt good to her. It felt real.
"Can you sit up?" he asked.
She raised herself to her elbows and shook her head to clear it. Pain lingered, but its intensity was a distant thing. Her whole body felt battered. It was too difficult to pinpoint one single hurt more significant than the others. Where the current of magic had entered her shoulder, she felt nothing at all. She let her father and Savano help her to her feet. Shakily, she hooked a strand of hair behind her ear. An odd gray light stole the contrast of oil lamp and night from the throne room. With some surprise, she realized morning had finally dawned, and its dusky light had brightened the east side windows. Nobles murmured among themselves in weary tones. Brienne and Rory stirred on the floor, grimacing and rubbing their eyes. Fashton crouched by them. Captain Mapstone sat beside a dazed Beryl Spencer, who cradled her head in her hands. Conley held his sword to the jowls of Tomas Merwell. Jindara stood over the body of Hamilton Hillander. Her bloodied sword hung loose in her hand. She shook her head and tossed the sword aside. The clatter of metal on stone woke everyone up. All eyes fell on her. Her eyes found Kerrigan. "We are even, Greeny," she said. Kerrigan opened her mouth to speak, but just then, the throne room doors burst open, and weapons and soldiers dressed in silver and black spilled into the room. The door hidden behind the tapestry opened as well, and weapons, followed by horse Marshal Martell and his cavalry soldiers, issued in. The opening of the doors dissipated the last of the spell that had cloaked the room.
Horse Marshal Martell and the weapons sought out the king to ensure he was well. Kerrigan could not tell from where she stood, but he seemed well, at least as well as she was. He looked dazed and exhausted, with blood staining his mustache and beard.
"We need some menders here,"
Marshal Martell said to one of his officers,
"and double quick."
A weapon knelt by the corpse of Devon Wainwright. Others joined him, and they spoke in low voices. They stood and turned to the king.
"We seek the one who has killed Devon."
Before the king could respond, Jandara stepped forward and said,
"I did."
Swords hissed out of sheaths. A black ring of weapons closed in on her.
"I know you, traitor," one said. "Devon was our teacher." "You shall suffer Savaril's fate," another said.
Jandara stared coldly at each of her captors.
"I was once Devon's student, too. I learned much from her."
She looked them over critically, as if gauging them, as if they had fallen far beneath her standards. Then, she lunged. One of the weapons reacted by raising his sword to stop her. Jandara did not stop.
"No!"
Kerrigan cried. But her father enclosed her in his arms and swept her down the throne room runner and through the great oaken doors. Homeward. Kerrigan walked along the pasture fence, in the bright blue silks her father had given her, feeling odd after so long wearing the uniform of the messenger service. The silk felt light and billowy on her skin, as if she wore nothing at all. She squinted in the sun, watching Condor frisk with some other horses. He cantered across the pasture, his tail held high like a flag, and his ears pricked forward. Kerrigan laughed aloud when he halted in his tracks, to roll and grunt in a patch of mud. Mel would not be happy when it came time to groom him.
"Carefree, aren't they?"
Kerrigan turned in surprise to find Beryl Spencer standing behind her. Incredibly, she still wore her scarlet uniform, with the incongruous winged horse brooch fastened to her short coat. She held the reins to a bay mare tacked with saddlebags for long travel. The mare's ears flopped back and forth, and she nickered at the frolicking horses. Beryl patted the horse's neck.
"This is Luna Morph," she said. "I just call her Luna. She would much prefer to be playing with her friends rather than leaving." "Where are you off to?"
Beryl glanced at the reins in her hands, then back up at Kerrigan. "Now that old Lord Murwell is under lock and key, and those in his army who will not be executed are marching home, I thought I would return to Murwell Province and see what good I could do there. After all, I still hold an officer's commission in the provincial army."
"You can't be serious," Kerrigan said. "They must know the part you played."
Beryl smiled brightly, an expression Kerrigan had never seen on the serious woman's face before. "It is generally believed Green Riders are a reckless lot, always galloping off into trouble. More or less it is true, and hopelessly so." She shrugged. "It may be no one in Murwell is aware of my affiliations. After all, anyone privy to the information has been killed or locked up, and may yet face execution."
"It isn't just reckless," Kerrigan said. "You're endangering yourself."
"Perhaps, but maybe the new Lord Governor will welcome one who can help him ease into his new position. After all, no one knows that position better than I. Besides, King Zachary desires a liaison to watch over Murwell Province and, shall we say, influence the new Lord Governor's loyalties." Kerrigan frowned. Her old nemesis from school, Temus Murwell, was going to be Lord Governor. In a way, his actions had precipitated the ultimate fall of his father. He had caused her to run away from Selium, which caused her to meet Free in Kobolbay, which caused her to carry the message.
"Bad things may await me in Murwell," Beryl said, "but I can't try to change the province from here. Besides, I can be quite persuasive." She touched her brooch. "How about you? What will you do? I know Captain Mapstone is keen to swear you in. We're so short of riders now."
Kerrigan smoothed some breeze-tousled hair out of her face.
This afternoon I leave for Corsa with my father, she said. I could be leading my own cargo trains within the year. Beryl reached out and clasped Kerrigan's hand. Good luck, she said. I find it hard to imagine you as a merchant. It sounds rather tame. Good luck to you, Kerrigan replied. Watch your back around Temus. Beryl stuck her toe in the stirrup and mounted Luna gracefully. That's Lord Temus to you. She grinned, and with a wave of her hand, she was off. Kerrigan snorted. Lord Temus? She did not envy Beryl. Her wanderings led her into the quiet of the inner courtyard gardens. She sat cross-legged on a stone bench warmed by the sun, and cupped her chin in her hands, intent on watching bees crawl in and out of the rose blossoms. A hummingbird buzzed by and chased another from a blossom. It was hard to believe she had killed a man in this peaceful place, not so long ago. She rubbed the cold spot on her shoulder, the spot that stayed cold, despite the heat that beat down on her. It was the place the tendril of black magic had scored her flesh, and although her various bruises, bumps, strains, and even the sword slash were taking care of themselves, this wound was slow to heal. The skin was punctured and burned, but did not hurt. On the contrary, it lacked feeling. The menders did not understand it. They applied a variety of poultices, but nothing seemed to have much of an effect on it. So absorbed in her thoughts was she that she did not hear the approach of another until a shadow fell on her. She gazed up and discovered the tall, blonde, green-eyed lady she had seen in the throne room. She was familiar, but Kerrigan couldn't place just where they had met before.
Hello, the woman said. Am I intruding?
No, Kerrigan said. May I sit? Kerrigan dropped her feet to the ground and moved over so there was room on the bench for two.
I almost did not recognize you without the green uniform, the woman said.
Her own gown of aqua and deep gold was a summery contrast to the black Kerrigan remembered her wearing in the throne room. Kerrigan tried to figure out who she was. The accent was Eastern, her bearing that of nobility.
I'm sorry, she said, but have we met before?
The woman's eyes danced.
Yes, under very mysterious circumstances.
Recognition struck Kerrigan, and she wondered how she had missed it before. Lady Astora!
I'm glad for this opportunity to talk to you without a veil on, so you would know who it was you helped. I wish to tell you what a comfort it has been to have Freyan's final letter.
Kerrigan smiled. I'm glad I could help.
I now know what else that letter contained. Captain Mapstone told me all about it, and all you endured to bring it.
Lady Astora's eyebrows became set, and her tone more serious.
You know, that night in the throne room, I saw much in you that reminded me of Freyan.
I didn't know him, Kerrigan said. At least, not well. Lady Astora seemed to search for the right words.
You were not going to let anything stop you, and you did not. That was very like Freyan.
Kerrigan looked at her knees. I couldn't stop. I was afraid. I was afraid for my father. I was afraid for the king. And I was afraid for me. If I stopped... She spread her hands wide for Lady Astora to come to her own conclusion. Lady Astora studied her thoughtfully. Something wrong? Kerrigan asked.
No.
Lady Astora shook her head, and her hair shimmered in the sunshine like a river of gold.
Freyan was never, forgive me, strong enough to admit fear. He shrugged it off like nothing, but I could see it in his eyes.
They sat in silence for a while, lumpy white clouds sailing across the sky far above, and a toad scampering beneath some bushes. A hummingbird darted from blossom to blossom with whirring wings. All of these small details of life Kerrigan had taken for granted. Presently, Lady Astora asked, "Will you be staying in Sakar City?" Kerrigan shook her head.
No, I'm returning to Corsa. You?
My father wants me to find a good suitor. Lady Astora rolled her eyes. Kutre province is isolated by the Wingsong Range, and a treacherous stretch of coast. He thought I'd have a better chance of meeting a fine young nobleman here. I thought if you were staying, we could be friends.
Kerrigan smiled regretfully. But now Lady Astora was gazing across the courtyard. I believe someone is waiting to speak to you.
Kerrigan followed her gaze. Standing at the far end of the courtyard was King Zachary, watching her expectantly. She pushed her hair behind her ear and licked her lips nervously. Why did the king make her feel so out of sorts?
You had better go, Lady Astora said. It is not good to keep a king waiting.
Kerrigan smiled weakly and bid Lady Astora farewell. She walked the gravel path amid shrubbery and flower beds. As she approached, a weapon stepped in her way to intercept her.
It's all right, Wilson, the king said. This is Kerrigan Gladion.
The weapon's expression brightened, and he bowed.
I am usually guarding the tombs, he said. But recent upheavals have me on duty here. There has been much talk down below of your deeds.
Kerrigan reddened. Before she could respond, however, Wilson slipped away to a discreet distance, leaving her and the king to stare awkwardly at one another. King Zachary looked well, but as if he had aged years. There were new lines crossing his brow and hollows beneath his eyes. She could not imagine the strain he had been under dealing with his brother's betrayal and death. The treachery of those he believed loyal, and the deaths of those who had remained loyal, had undoubtedly taken their toll on him as well. Finally, he said,
"Would you walk with me?"
Kerrigan fell into step with him on the gravel pathway.
I have just stepped outside for some fresh air, he said. It seems summer has finally found us.
Yes, Kerrigan said. Another silence fell between them. He began.
We,
she said. They stopped and glanced at one another.
Kerrigan, he said. I still haven't heard a full account of what went on in the throne room that night. I was a bit dazed, you know, when you broke the spell binding my brother to the Elysian. It seems you and my brother vanished momentarily. Laren, Captain Mapstone, seems to think it wasn't the power of your brooch. Where did you go? What happened?
Kerrigan felt the energy drain from her. She disliked revisiting that night, for it hounded her in her dreams and intruded on her waking thoughts. Over the last week, she had found too much idle time to mull over what could have been. What if she had made the wrong choice? What if she had taken the Elysian up on his challenge to a game of intrigue? What if she had lost? The vicious whirl of what-ifs exhausted her. She started to turn away, but the king caught her arm.
Please, he said.
She nodded. It is still strange to me. And there, in the courtyard, among the fragrant flowers, the buzz of bees, and the trill of birdsong, she told King Zachary of her experiences in the white void in which she had been trapped. The longer she talked, the wider his eyes grew. Her heart grew lighter as her words poured out. She realized as she spoke, she had made the only choice she could have possibly made, and that none of the alternatives would have made sense to her then, or ever. In relating her experiences to the king, she also learned she did not have to carry the burden of those choices by herself.
I have heard, he said when she finished, there are many layers to the world. The domain of the gods is one layer. The world of the afterlife is another. I have also heard that when you use magic, you enter yet another layer. Perhaps this is what happened.
I don't know, Kerrigan said. Agamon called it a transitional place. The king shifted the sling on his shoulder.
Kerrigan, you have astonished me time and again. I am more grateful than you know for all that you have done. Without you, my brother would have taken all and destroyed Sacharidia.
Chandora, Carrigan said, stopped your brother.
She killed my brother, but it is you who stopped him and the Elysian. I know there was an understanding of some kind between you and Chandora, but know that in the end, she found the most merciful way out for herself. The justice of weapons is ancient and brutal. Despite her final act, the weapons would have branded her a traitor, and she would have suffered a great deal prior to execution.
Carrigan glanced down at her feet. I know. I hope she wasn't buried in some unmarked grave.
She is where she deserves, interred beside my brother, in the halls of kings and queens, albeit along a more obscure avenue. But I do not wish to speak of tombs.
The song of a chickadee perched on a slender white birch lilted across the courtyard. The king put his fingers beneath her chin and raised her face into the sunlight.
I'm asking you, no, imploring you, to reconsider joining the Green Riders. Your valor will not be forgotten.
I can't, she began. He cut her off.
I simply ask you to reconsider. Go spend time with your family, and think about it. If you return to Selium to finish your schooling, all the better.
I'm not going back there, she said. That's how I got into this mess in the first place.
The king's brown eyes danced with amusement.
A Green Rider should soon be handing Dean Geyer a message sealed with a royal mark, explaining how erroneously he judged you. You are free to return there.
Carrigan wasn't sure whether to be relieved or annoyed that she no longer had an excuse to stay away from Selium. It would not do to appear ungrateful, however.
Thank you, she murmured.
He grinned with a lightness she did not expect, and he took her hand into his.
Your deeds will not be forgotten, brave lady.
He kissed her hand and bowed. With that, he turned away, his cloak rustling behind him as he strode off. Carrigan returned to her room at Ryder Barracks, feeling rather giddy and blushing madly. Her saddlebags were packed, and there was little to do but await her father. She sighed and leaned against the window frame. The wind bent the grasses of the pasture, and the horses grazed in the distance. The king. He stirred up feelings in her that she would rather not think about. She was leaving Sacker City to be a merchant, or was she simply running away again? She would miss Sacker City, but she would miss the people even more. King Zachary, Mel, Captain Mapstone, Fastian, and Alton Dyer. Alton had left the city 2 days ago for his ancestral home. He was supposed to help figure out how to mend the breach in the Dyer Wall. He was sorry she had decided not to stay on, and he made her promise to visit frequently. After the Battle of the Lost Lake and the discovery of his shielding talent, he finally felt like a proper Green Rider. The door creaked open, and her father strode in, looking resplendent in a cloak of sky blue. He placed his hands on his hips and smiled broadly at her.
Ready?
He asked. She grinned and crossed the floor to embrace him. He felt as he always had, with his arms around her, strong and safe and warm.
I'm glad you're here, she said.
Her father laughed aloud.
I'm glad we both are.
Carrigan pulled away and looked up at him.
What has you in such good spirits?
I've had some meetings with Captain Mapstone. She told me many things about your journey, things you had not told me. It took seeing it through the captain's eyes for me to realize how much you've grown.
Carrigan made a face. I am Carrigan Glavian, merchant.
I told the captain that. She is short on messengers and thought I could talk you into joining up. I told her you were returning to Corsa with me. Even so, she insisted upon riding out of the city with us.
Carrigan threw her saddlebags over her shoulder. She was pleased the captain was joining them, and she could tell by the sparkle in her father's eye that he, too, was pleased. They found Captain Mapstone by the stable, holding the reins to Bluebird. She looked well and rested. Only a small bandage on her forehead and a slight limp hinted at the battle she had endured. According to Mel, it had been no easy task keeping the captain quiet while she recuperated. The menders had their hands full with her, and many had simply thrown their hands up in exasperation when she stubbornly disobeyed their instructions. Mel and Savano led the other horses out of the stable. Carrigan hugged Mel soundly. The girl was as cheerful as ever, but Carrigan wondered if the night of the takeover ever plagued her dreams. She would not talk about it, but preoccupied herself with chores around the stables or running about the castle with messages.
"It seems like we keep saying goodbye," Carrigan said.
"You'll be back," Mel said.
"I'm not too sure about that."
Mel grinned and handed over Condor's reins.
"The captain is thinking about sending me to Selium for school."
Carrigan patted her friend on the shoulder. In a low voice, she said,
"A little advice if you go. Don't ever think about running away."
Mel chuckled and hurried off into the stable. The foursome mounted and rode in silence across the castle grounds and through the gates. Captain Abel and his guardsmen, who had swung from nooses at the gate, had been removed and buried with honor. Still, Carrigan couldn't help but feel a certain dread when she passed beneath the portcullis. In the city, the added security was evident everywhere. Soldiers in silver and black patrolled the streets in pairs and questioned travelers, particularly Morwellians, at the gates. However, the hawking of merchandise from street-side booths and the singing and playing of buskers and the bustle of people flowing this way and that had not changed. Captain Mapstone nosed Bluebird alongside Condor. Carrigan's father and the cargo master rode on ahead. The captain twisted in her saddle so she could look directly at Carrigan. Her hazel eyes were intent.
"I am sure King Zachary requested you join the messenger service," she said. "Add my invitation as well."
Stevet Glavian overheard and opened his mouth to protest, but the captain forestalled him with a stern glance. "Hold, merchant. You agreed to let me have my say." He pursed his lips, but could not contain himself.
"Yes, and a lot more."
"You made a bargain, if you recall," Captain Mapstone said.
Carrigan raised her eyebrows.
"Bargain?"
"I found you, more or less," the captain explained.
"Your father agreed long ago to re-outfit my unit, which happens to be the whole of the messenger service, if I found you."
She turned her hazel eyes back on Stevic.
"Remember, make them conservative and green."
Stevic rolled his eyes.
"Arik and Orion preserve me from making deals with green riders."
He shook his head and turned his attention back to the road ahead.
"Them?" Carrigan asked, mystified.
"Uniforms," the captain smiled smugly. They rode for a bit more, and the smile faded to a more thoughtful expression.
"Carrigan, please consider joining us. You have shown rare courage, and we would be proud to have you."
Carrigan worked the reins between her fingers and looked down at her hands. She felt the pull of the green riders, but didn't understand it. She needed some time to think it over.
"No, I don't..."
The captain cut her off.
"You do not have to decide now. I won't pressure you. I believe you will feel enough pressure in, well, other ways."
The captain did not explain further, and the conversation shifted to more inconsequential things for the duration of the ride through the city. She rode with them through the last gate, then halted.
"I have some things for you," she said to Carrigan.
She reached behind herself and unfastened a saddle sheath complete with saber. She presented it to Carrigan.
"This isn't the blade of the first rider, though I think you deserve to carry it. Agamon of the Tombs demanded its return. This was Freyan's."
Carrigan ran her fingers across the worn leather sheath.
"I recognize it."
"You have his brooch and horse," Captain Mapstone said. "It seems logical for you to have his sword as well. I think he would be pleased."
"Thank you," Carrigan said.
One more thing. Captain Mapstone's expression became grave, and she